across the UK, across continental North America, and around the world on the internet by webcast and by podcast. My name is Howard Hughes, and this is The Unexplained. Thank you for being part of my show. The reason I'm sounding so happy at the moment, I think, is that a shaft of sunlight is piercing my apartment at the moment. It's really beautiful. Lovely blue sky. But this morning, for hour upon hour upon hour, it rained heavily. I mean, like consistently beating on the windows. And I thought, well, that's it then. No more sunshine until about March next year, which, you know, I hate the winter. I don't know how I get through it most years. Maybe you're the same. But lovely right now. Thank you very much for all of your emails. Thank you to Adam, my webmaster, for his continued hard work on The Unexplained. Guest on this edition of The Unexplained, a man called Brian Allen, and another book published by Philip Mantle's Flying Disc Press. This is a really neat book. And I think, having been through it today and yesterday, that it would make a great Christmas gift for somebody. You know, I'm not here to sell books, but it's a really good book. Brian Allen is the man who's going to be on here. And the book is called, and you know, I had to do this, because any book that's called The Book of Secrets, Aliens, Ghosts, and Ancient Mysteries, and you know, that's got me hooked from the start. On the book jacket, it says, Brian Allen has had an abiding interest in all kinds of paranormal and occult phenomena since his first encounter, aged around three. Although initially, his interest in the subject was passive, involving studying books, etc., over the last 50 years or so, he's been involved in a hands-on basis. During this time, he's witnessed some genuinely astonishing phenomena and met amazing people. He's written 14 books dealing with various aspects of the paranormal in one way or another, and he's currently the editor of the international online publication Phenomena Magazine. So, you know, this guy's got a great track record, and I can tell you, it's a lovely, compact, crisply written book, and there are some great stories in it. We won't get time to deal with all of them, but I think I'm going to give you a flavour of it here. So that's what we're going to do. Thanks again for all of the emails. Don't forget, if you'd like to make a donation to The Unexplained, thank you very much if you have recently. You know who you are. Please go to the website, theunexplained.tv. And if you have made a donation, like I say, recently, thank you very much. From the bottom of my heart, thank you. It's very kind of you, because, you know, these are, as we all know, these are hard times, and, you know, you need a little bit of fuel to keep on going. All right. I think that's more or less it. One other thing, very quickly, if you want to get in touch by email, tell me who you are, where you are, and how you use the show, which you're kind enough to do in the main already. And don't forget, of course, if you require a reply or response, please put that clearly at the top of the email. All right, let's get to Brian Allen now, and we're going to talk about his book and his research and his life. The book is Book of Secrets. Brian, thank you very much for coming on.
You're more than welcome. Thank you for asking me. I'm indeed honored.
14 books and quite an illustrious history from what I read in your biography here. Before we do anything, can you talk with me about yourself and about Phenomena Magazine?
Well, Phenomena Magazine, well, yeah. I was invited 9 years ago to come and edit the magazine. I had been editing a newsstand magazine called Paranormal, and the recession hit, and the guy that owned the magazine wasn't getting the returns he wanted, so the magazine folded. And I'd known Steve Mira, who founded Phenomena Magazine a while back, and if Steve knew what had happened, he said, would I like to come aboard as assistant editor? Well, I was doing nothing else anyway, so he says, yeah, why not? But Steve had a lot of stuff going on at the time, and he saw that I was more than capable of doing it. So he said, look, you just want to be the editor, and I'll just stand back and, you know, and just put it online. I said, yeah, whatever. So I've been editing it full time since, well, for the last 9 years, I guess.
And over the 9 years, nearly a decade, what sorts of stuff have you covered, if that's not too broad a question?
Well, have you got a spade and shovel and we can just dig it out? Yeah, absolutely. You name it, we've covered it. And I mean literally everything. So there's nothing that's... No, we've covered about every paranormal subject you can think on, and a few that might not be paranormal, but were interesting anyway, and we just covered them. So, yeah, everything, just anything and everything.
We weren't down to talk about this, but I'm sure you'll know all about this. I wonder if you have anything new to tell us about the... Because it's made the papers again this year. Anything new to tell us about the... And I'm calling it, because I have some experience of Scotland, but I might be wrong here, the Calvine case. Is it Calvin or Calvine?
Calvine.
Calvine, yeah, I thought so. Do you know anything more about the Calvine case? Just to tell my listener, or remind my listener, this was a couple of guys, 1990, I believe, was the year.
Yeah.
And they were, I think they were forestry workers, and they saw this remarkable craft moving at high speed in that location, being pursued or escorted or chased or something by what appeared to be an Air Force aircraft. Now, some photographs they took, mm-hmm. and those photographs were given to a local newspaper, to a national Scottish newspaper. The MOD requested those pictures, and I believe they disappeared for a long period. I think the negatives have resurfaced somewhere, but there's a lot of talk about it now, and I wondered what you might know.
Well, I think the last I read about the case, I think it was Dr. David Clark. He raised the case again as being one of the few. Well, and this guy is a thoroughgoing skeptic. I would say that the Calvine case is one of the few images of a UFO that he would accept as being genuine. So, other than that, as a sort of a confirmation or a I can't tell you anything new on it other than David Clark seems to think it's genuine. So, who am I to argue? And if it is, God only knows what happened to it, because I have no idea. I'm not going to make things up. I don't know. Other than it is a genuine picture.
But what we both know about that, and it's interesting to get your view that this is a genuine picture, because there are some people who say, I think there have been people who claimed it was a fishing lure, you know, and all sorts of things. But the consensus seems to be that there is a lot genuine about this picture, and there's a lot more to tell about the story. So we'll keep an eye out for that.
Absolutely. But do keep in mind that... you could put a real-life ET in front of somebody, and they're so tied up in their scepticism that even supposing it bit them on the backside, they still wouldn't admit it was real, so, you know.
Mm. All right, let's get to the book then, and there's a very... I mean, I've already said in the introduction to this, to my listener, that this is a very nice, crisply written book that would make a very good Christmas read, I think, for people. You know, not that I'm here in the business of selling books, but... That's my thought. You say, in the introduction, you say there have been many attempts to encapsulate and explain the many enigmas and mysteries that still surround us. These include everything from the mysterious contents of the Vatican's secret archives to the paranormal and ufology, and even some subjects that seem to defy definition and slip between the cracks of reality into the realms of head-scratching high strangeness. This book draws on all these threads as it weaves its way through the many twists, turns, and possibilities that define the subjects discussed. That is not all of it, but it's a great mission statement, Brian.
Well, yeah, the book, well, it was one of these, the book more or less wrote itself, to be quite honest with you. And I say that because it was stuff I'd lying about the hard drive that, you know, I've got a folder that, I'll write stuff and file it. I mean, although the magazines, they're very seldom published stuff in the magazine, especially under my own name. I always use pseudonyms because my ego doesn't need that amount of stroking, quite frankly. But this was stuff that it just built up and built up and built up, and I realised that at some point it was thematic. So I pretty well drew it into different categories and just produced 22 chapters of just subjects relating to the paranormal. The book itself tells you pretty much what it's about. It's a book of secrets, aliens, ghosts, and ancient mysteries, and that just about covers it. If your readers are interested, it's actually published by Flying Disc Press, and it's out on Amazon now, but who am I to promote it?
No, well, indeed, I did mention that at the top of this, but it's always worth doing it again. And what I like about it is the fact that you... You don't really shilly-shally or mess about here. It's all very crisp, and you get to the point.
Mm-hmm.
You're saying?
There's no point in messing about in this, because I've found out that equivocation about this subject, that people tend to waffle on and on and on about different aspects of it, and they're not really getting anywhere. So if I believe a subject is strong enough to stand up, then I'm prepared to lay my line out and say, yeah, I believe this, and here's why. And if people accept it, well and good. And if they don't, well, that's fine as well. So, you know, there you go. Yep.
All right. There are a few topics that you were keen to talk about, and there are a couple that I would like to bring in from the book, if that's okay. But let's get to the ones that you were keenest on. And one of them is ufology and the Collins elite, and you deal with that in specific specific terms, the Collins.
The Collins, elite, yeah.
Around about page 90, it's sort of page 88 starting there. And say, as regards the origins of the Collins elite in the USA, since all branches of the military plus the Defense Intelligence Agency were involved anyway, it was a relatively simple matter to draft in representatives under the stewardship of initially the FBI, then the CIA, and perhaps even the National Security Agency itself.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
This semi-official subgroup was created in 1952 and allegedly became nicknamed the Collins Elite. I don't know much about it. Can you tell me?
Okay, well, to be honest, the whole thing about the Collins Elite, I came across it through Nick Redfern. He had mentioned it in one of his books. And I came across this, and it was new to me. But in recent years, it seems to have picked up some traction. And a lot of people are talking about this just now, but what it was, if you go back to the night, it was after 1947. In fact, this was, the Collins Elite started in the early 50s, and the problem was, or the curiosity was, does it still exist to this day? And the answer is probably yes, because when it was started up, it was one of these many oft-denied projects set out by the US government into the existence or reality of UFOs, which have always denied up to now, although it's starting to get progressively harder to do so. But the Collins Elite was set up to look into this, and its name actually came from, I believe, one of the members of the group, although who they are remains in the shadows. It's not at all clear who was actually involved in this group. But quite a few people were, and one of them apparently was named Collins. But the trouble with the Collins Elite was, it's not that it couldn't find any reality for UFOs, or UAPs, if whatever you want to call them nowadays, but they had an agenda. And that agenda appears to have come from fundamentalist Christians who had very strict ideas of what UFOs were and what was piloting them. Now, as far as they were concerned, the Collins Elite carried this straitjacket of belief that UFOs were satanic in origin and they were crewed by demons, and these demons were out to subvert the human race.
And we have to say that that particular narrative, if you think that narrative belongs to the 50s or whenever, you're wrong, because that narrative, as far as I am told, is still playing in Washington today.
Oh yeah, I would have got to that.
Sorry, I jumped in.
No, we're just going around the houses a little bit there. Yeah, but the whole idea, it definitely had this agenda, but there was another side to it as well, that they weren't crewed by demons; they were crewed by angels. But it's the same sort of subgroup that still seems to insist on this today. Now, the strange thing is that groups like these tend to poo-poo and marginalise the paranormal as a subject. They say it's not real, you know, don't be silly, this doesn't exist. But on the other hand, they bring their own religious beliefs forward, which are also supernatural, of course, and promote them. So it always seems to me a great deal, very, very cynical, I think, and hypocritical, if they can accept that one group is paranormal and another group isn't, while promoting a paranormal agenda themselves. But you know, that's just my opinion. But the actual, the book, that particular chapter, it was just an attempt to promote that the Collins Elite, what it was, what it did, and that it's still around to this day, as you rightly say. And yeah, it's an interesting viewpoint to take. And it also, I think, casts a rather bright searchlight into the heart of the whole UFO enigma and how the authorities view it, I think.
And, you know, if you believe that UFOs are piloted by demons, well, you know, I don't know that they're not, but then I don't know that they're not piloted by, you know, an extraterrestrial species from Alpha Centauri has our best interests at heart. We simply don't know the answers to those questions.
Yeah.
But it's interesting to flag up the fact that there are still people who think that. And you know, some of these things may well be demonic in origin, but we don't know much about the narrative and how high it goes. At least we didn't know much about it until you wrote this chapter. I didn't know much about it for sure. Okay, well, that's an interesting thing to discuss. You're also interested in the secrets of the Vatican archive. Now, Vatican's interesting because we know that the Vatican has not one but two observatories and has a huge interest for reasons that I'm not quite sure why they might. I can surmise, but I'm not here to do that. It's not, you know, it's not for me to do that here. Mm-hmm. But the Vatican seems to collect an awful lot of information and data that is not specifically directly connected with the religion. And you discuss this in the book. Talk to me about that.
Okay, well, the Vatican Secret Archive, people should be aware that when they say a secret archive, they're not kidding. I mean, people can get access to it, but they better have a damn good reason for doing so. And their credentials better be very good as well, otherwise they wouldn't get past the front door. The archive themselves, it was originally thought that it was just stuff the church had picked up over the years. Everything from, you know, medieval shopping lists to all sorts of just stuff that was associated with the church. But it seems to be that as well as some of the things I'm going to mention, there's information in there that would bring the church crashing down, because there's a lot of contradictions in religion itself, in the nature of God, the creation and all the rest of it, and especially the origins of the Catholic Church, which can be viewed with, you know, I don't want to go down this road because it upsets too many people.
Well, yes, it does, and I think it's, you know, it's best not to, and we must respect all people's faiths and beliefs. But absolutely. However, the fact that there is an archive and that it contains so much stuff is of great fascination, I think.
Yeah, well, the thing is that one of the main contents of the archive, and they'll only be tiny. There's 7 fragments of bone that are said to be the bones of St. Peter, who obviously founded the Catholic Church, you know, millennia ago. And these bones, as I say, they're too old to get any sort of DNA off them. But they are said to be the bones of St. Peter, and as the founder of that particular faith, they are very much venerated, and they have been actually been recognised. I can't remember, it was one of the more recent popes. He decided that this is what they were, and, you know, and they should be treated with great respect. Another thing that's supposed to be in there is the real third secret of Fatima, because what was released about 20-25 years ago has been, or 20, maybe 30 years ago, has been the third secret of Fatima, was made for public consumption, as far as it's known, and the real secret that came from that little girl really is a pretty an apocalyptic view of what's still to come, because it names names and gives dates and all the rest of it, and it also reinforces the opinion that the current Pope's going to be the last one, whatever that actually means and whatever the implications of that, I don't know.
Do you believe, Brian, that that's the reason why this has not been released?
Yes, I do. I honestly do, because it ties into what comes next, because another, you might think, unlikely item that's actually concealed within these archives. And don't forget, when people talk about the Vatican, the place is gigantic. It's a city. I mean, it's not just a building, it's a city. And apparently, it is entombed in there is supposedly Satan. Or whether it's the corpse or the still living entity of Satan is supposedly locked away, secreted within the archive. Now, that's a pretty big claim to make, I think you'll agree, but whether it's true or not, nobody knows.
What sorts of people have made that claim?
People like you and me, basically, Howard. It's not, these sort of claims don't come from you know, clerics, shall we say, but they have reputedly come from within the Vatican, that Satan is entombed, or his remains are entombed, or the living entity, evil entity that is Satan, is entombed, somehow is incarcerated within the Vatican. But as I say, how much truth you can put on that, I wouldn't like to speculate upon. But one thing, or a group of things that are down in the archives, are a series of grimoires. Now, as you know, and many of the listeners will know, a grimoire is basically a book of spells. That's a recipe book of magic, if you like. And amongst these grimoires is the most notorious grimoire supposedly ever written, which is the Grimoire of Pope Honorius III, which is said to have been the most evil collection of works ever assembled in one single place. And it is so, I mean, you're never going to see this thing, but it does exist, and it was written, and it is apparently within the archive. But there are even, if it has got to be handled, and I mean, to get out of storage is quite a performance in itself, because grimoires, by their very nature, were dangerous to handle. And especially this one, which is the most evil of them all.
What, because they're cursed?
Yes, well, yeah. Yeah, that's a very good way of putting it. They are cursed by nature of what they contain. And there's a special rigmarole's got to be gone through to get them out, to get them handled, to get them opened, closed, and put back and sealed again, to make sure that they can't mess with people who are just passers-by, although I rather suspect these would be well beyond the grasp of passers-by, especially in how they'll be actually put away. But that's another thing that's supposed to be. But there's another, perhaps, stranger and even less likely. And so it's a device called the chronovisor. It was actually created amongst that by other people, a physicist, a Father Emeti, who created this device. It's virtually a TV set to look into the past. And if any of the listeners care to Google chronovisor, C-H-R-O-N-O-V-I-S-O-R, chronovisor, they'll actually see pictures of this thing, which is like a TV screen sitting on a column. Now, I would have tended to go, yeah, well, come on, maybe. But I've come across references, and don't ask me where I got this other reference because it's gone right out of my head, but it was a sideways reference to this chronovisor that didn't come from the mainstream that usually talks about this kind of stuff. And it did infer that there's a means of seeing into the past, a device of some kind within the Vatican that allows them to look into the past. The crucifixion of Christ and so forth and so on have all been viewed during the chronovisor. And it was, as I said, the people that were involved in constructing it might have had the qualifications to go about this. Although if they did, I tend to suspect it would have been longer weaponized by the governments of various countries of the world and used as a weapon of war. But again, this is supposed to be there. But the other thing, that I suppose it's one of the last things, the great secrets of what's supposed to be in there, is absolute 100% proof of extraterrestrial life. Now, it might not be in the Vatican's interest for that to get out, because that would cause all sorts of questions to be asked. For example, and it's one that's always occurred to me, if there are ETs out in Alpha Reticuli or Zeta Reticuli or whatever, and they visit us, and we were to communicate with them, and we talked about God and all the rest of it, and they sort of went, "Who? God? What's God?" And they had no concept of a supreme being that created the universe, then that would cause all sorts of problems for all sorts of religions for all sorts of reasons. And that is the reason why I think if they have definitive proof of ET life, they'll hang on to it for as long as they possibly can. And even then, they might even deny it. But yeah, so that's just some of the things that's supposed to be secreted away in the archive.
And
but
nevertheless, you know, Brian, we know that they have these observatories, so they're very keen to keep an eye on the skies.
Absolutely, of course they are, because I suppose it's in their interest to do so. But like I say, if they have definitive proof, I think they'd be very leery about bringing it into public life for the reasons I've just mentioned.
You talk about another subject, many subjects in this book, that are of particular interest to me, and I'm glad that you've done this. With some of these things, they're in danger of being forgotten, and that's sad because the people involved maybe have passed, or the public discourse on these things is not as great as it might be, and you know, you might get a tabloid newspaper who will resurrect this, you know, for one story, but they're in danger of slipping away. One such is the Montauk Project.
And, oh, Montauk, yeah.
The particular involvement of a man who I interviewed before his death twice for The Unexplained at length. And I always thought that he sounded very credible, even though his story could be deemed to be outlandish. His name, Al Bierlich, man who claimed that he was involved as a naval seaman, along with his brother, in a project to, well, effectively it was to demonstrate invisibility of a naval ship. And this was during the war.
The Philadelphia experiment.
The Philadelphia experiment, which they made a movie, a middling kind of movie about. Not the greatest movie that's ever been made, but at least they made it. And this ship was said to have, rather than become invisible, it was transported through the use of electromagnetic technology, which allegedly still exists, transported in time to the future. So Al Bierlich, some people died because of the time shifting. They were trapped between the steelwork of the ship as it transposed itself. But Al Bierlich and his brother apparently were catapulted forward in time to a place where there were things that there weren't in the 1940s, like color television and knowledge of our conquest of the moon and those sorts of things. And then he came back and had his identity changed. And, you know, he was here until a number of years ago, not very many years ago, to talk about this thing. Now, a lot of people have poured a lot of scorn and cold water over this case, but I'm glad that you documented, Brian.
I did so because I think it's worth keeping a hold of, as you say, for the very reason that, that people tend to forget about this. But what happened in Montauk and the Beast of Montauk and so forth, if they really were messing around with space-time, which in effect they were, and if the Philadelphia experiment happened as described, in fact, to correct it, they've made two films and I've seen both of them, to be honest. The whole concept is interesting because it involves the actual reduction of physical objects down to their very component atoms, transmitting them, then picking them up again and reassembling them. Because to do that, to actually separate a whole ship and its crew and everything on board that ship into separate items rather than just one big discrete lump, and then to re-scramble again into all these individual components, the technology to do that must have been astonishing. Because how on earth could you tell a human cell from a fragment of metal? How could you do that? Because the computer the only thing that bothers me about it is the computer technology to do it, because you would need to have some pretty smart AI to do this. And this is why I tend to be a bit leery about the Philadelphia experiment and what it implied, simply because of the fact trying to tell the difference between a human being and a transistor radio or a human being and a gun. I mean, how do you tell the difference? And how would a machine know the difference if it was doing that? Because this might take it out with the realm of machines and computers and all the rest of it. This might take it into the way of a transfer of consciousness. If you can accept that at some level everything is conscious, this is when you start getting into belief systems like animism. Now, the animists believe that everything, even a blade of grass, the leaf in a tree, whatever, is in itself a living entity, and it has consciousness of a sort. And if you were to do it that way and view it from that point of view, then it might be possible, because the computing power of a brain or a consciousness is literally limitless. And it would take something of that order to control the series of shifts that would need to take place to transpose a ship from one place and plant it down another. It's all very well for science fiction writers to say, oh, they did it using this, that, or the next thing. But the hard nitty-gritty of it is near impossible to contemplate unless you start moving away from the merely physical into the almost spiritual.
I had never thought of it that way, and thank you very much for suggesting that, because I'd always looked at it in a very mechanistic way, that it was a mechanical thing that happened.
Surely.
But
absolutely.
Actually, if they were using, with this ship, the Eldridge, electromagnetic forces of that that power and potency, then of course we know from our own experience that those things, we know from power lines to a small extent, but other ways that electromagnetism has been used, that might have been some shifting of whatever was going on in and around the brain.
Yeah.
And who knows what those people subjected to it then believed that they experienced, and whether that was fantasy. Well, there were specific details that were beyond fantasy, as far as we understand.
Oh, yeah.
Or there was some kind of leap of consciousness forward in time. That's amazing. But Al Bielek himself became a very controversial character. He used to appear a lot on programs like mine, but also Art Bell's Coast to Coast AM back in the day. And he put a very credible story forward. He was not a man who sounded like he was telling, as we say here in the UK, porky pies, rhyming slang for lies.
But
unfortunately, because he's not here anymore and nobody seems to be carrying on the research, a line has been drawn under it all, and I personally think that's a shame.
Oh, it is. But as far as Bielek is concerned, I know about as much about him as you do, quite frankly, Howard. I mean, I'm not going to lie. I added him into the story because he was part of it. And the only information I could dig out came from stuff I'd read, came from memory, and other stuff that I sort of got off the net eventually, went looking for it. And I wrote it up, and I think I made some connections that had been made before, although offhand I can't remember them. But I know, I think I'm pretty sure I did. But Bielek himself was an interesting character, and he was tied to, they call it, the whole process, which is why I included him in it.
And his brother. He had a brother. An astonishing case. And if there's anybody hearing this right now who can steer me in the direction of anybody who might be doing some research into this right now, I would love to speak with them, because it was one of my favorite topics, because it was so intriguing. And there were more things connected to the Montauk Project.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that we've talked about here before. We don't have to go into now, but there were, you know, experiments done with people, young people quite often, which I believe involved sending them forward in time and making them part of a space exploration force. I think offhand was part of it, but some of it was cruel and nasty.
Oh, yeah.
And we've discussed this on this show before. So a fascinating thing. I'm glad that you had it in the book. Connected with that, and again, here's something else that 20 years ago was very hot button. Everybody seemed to talk about it. The papers were full of it. And no one talks about it now, sadly. The time traveler, John Titor,
What a great story.
I mean, you've got a whole chapter on John Titor. But to remind people, if they don't know, John Titor appeared around about that strange millennium time. You know, when they said that we might be affected by the Y2K bug that would effectively ruin all computing and send us back to the Stone Age. Of course, you know, whether it was because of the preparation that was done for it or whether it was never going to happen, we don't know. But nothing much, as far as we are aware, happened. John Titor appeared, as far as I recall, around about that time. And he was said to be a time traveler who'd been sent back here by a future, you know, organization, government, whatever, to seek out a computer component that was no longer made and nobody understood anymore.
That's
to
right.
Get one of those. That was the premise of it. Tell me what you make of the John Titor story in the book.
Well, the thing that sort of intrigued me about it was the close parallels it ran with the science fiction. What was the one with the DeLorean car?
Back to the Future.
Yeah. Because Titor's time machine appeared to be a clone of the DeLorean with all the gubbins in the back of it. In case your listeners don't know about this, but Titor started off as a purely internet entity, and he would contribute to various, write-ins, the various groups and all the rest of it. Then people started to take an interest, and likewise, with the increasing interest, so the output from Titor increased likewise. And he eventually started, I don't think we actually got an image of him, I can't remember 100%, I don't think there was ever an image of him, but there was always an image of the stuff that he was working on. And this time machine is stuffed in the back of a car. It wasn't a DeLorean, I might add. But all this, it emerged as well. And the whole thing really took off. And it was quite interesting for a while, because I can vaguely remember this, you know, years ago when it first appeared, although I had other interests at the time. But I thought it was well worth including as a sort of an icon of the sort of stuff that emerges in the sort of back rooms or the back pages of explorations into paranormal phenomena, because you could argue that what Titor was doing was basically paranormal in nature. All that kind of stuff is, because once you start moving into the subject of time travel, the whole thing becomes very, how can I put, the ground becomes unsteady under your feet. And anything becomes possible. And this is why I tend to try and keep a leash on it. Because I've found that if I start going down that road, I start to lose my touch with reality. And you can't be doing that. So sometimes I have to put the brakes on myself and say, well, Brian, stop. You're going too far. Just stop it. And I'm able to do that and just walk away from it for a while. But then I can come back and sort of dip my toes in and start off again. But that was why I included the chapter on Titor, because it was well worth it, I thought.
But we don't know, do we, whether there was any truth in it? And we don't have a handle on who was making these posts, which would be just as interesting.
No, well, that's what I'm saying, that Titor was never seen as a picture. There wasn't a guy, oh, there's John Titor. That never happened. But the devices that he produced were, and I think that was probably deliberate. absolutely deliberate on his part, because he couldn't be identified, obviously couldn't be identified then as being the guy that did all this. So if it was all a hoax, then he couldn't be stood up against the wall and said, ha, hoax or liar, we'll have nothing more to do with you. But yeah, it, like I say, interesting though in its own right.
And because, you know, if it was a hoax, sorry to dive in, well, here, but okay, you know, very elaborate and very involving. And what it did was it fired the starting pistol for stories that I see virtually every week in popular tabloid newspapers for people to come forward and say, I am a time traveler from the year 3300 and I'm here to warn you of the consequences of your current human actions. So what it does, if there are time travelers, and what the great Art Bell used to say is, you know, where are the time travelers? If there are time travelers, where are you? Let's see you. And a lot of people do that, but again, very elusive. And if there were time travelers, then they would be swamped by all the people posting fake messages from time travelers, and we wouldn't get very far. I wonder if that's part of somebody's plan, but that's just a conspiracy theorist.
I think it used to be called Fermi's paradox. I mean, if there are space, if there are ETs, where are they? You know, I think it was called Fermi's paradox. He came up with the same sort of thing as Art Bell, basically, the same sort of idea.
And you know, the one thing that you could argue about aliens and ETs and why they don't present themselves more forcefully and more publicly than they do is maybe they are so advanced, and look, what do I know about anything? But yeah, and we need to leave this point pretty quickly, but let's just say this: if they were so advanced, then maybe they understand that what they would have to tell us would be so destabilizing to society that we need to be good and ready for it, and we aren't now.
We certainly aren't, and in point of fact, as far as getting warnings from the far future about our future, I think we're making a good enough job of that ourselves, if you've got the eyes to see what's happening right around all around about us. Because the world, as far as I'm concerned, I mean, I'm not going to lie, I'm 2 years off, been 80 years of age now, and I've seen an awful lot of stuff in my time, and now is about as bad as I can remember it ever having been, to be honest.
True enough, and I think that's why a lot of us, I mean, look, I'm a news guy, but I like to do this because I think there are eternal questions here that transcend the current political ridiculousness and all sorts of strange things that are happening here. One of the things that you address, and have addressed before now even, is the notion and the question of who built the pyramids. I mean, there's another one of those great hot-button questions that we seem to be finding out. We seem to be deriving more questions than we're getting answers. What do you have to say about that?
Well, over the years, I've seen various hypotheses about how the pyramids were constructed. They were built using ramps made of sand, and there was thousands of guys dragged all the blocks up these ramps made of sand until they finally, what you actually ended up with was this block of sand with the pyramid inside it, and they scraped away the sand, and lo and behold, the pyramid appeared. But as far as moving those huge blocks of stone, in fact, not even the pyramids, it's these like 1,000-ton blocks of stone that are up, not Puma Punku, it's the other one. There's one of these ancient sites where there's like 1,000-ton blocks of stone have actually been shifted into place. Baalbek, that's it, Baalbek, I'm pretty sure. And I'm more interested, really, and I think I mentioned this somewhere in that chapter, about the Baalbek stones. How in God's name were they ever moved by human beings? Because I have no idea. Because I can't see human beings, irrespective of how many there were, and how heavy or how strong the ropes were, actually pulled these things ever into place without there being some sort of external force used. I mean, I have heard it suggested, and we'll go back to the pyramids as well with this, that some of the priests, or the, well, call them priests, the shaman, whatever, they had a device, like you call it a wand if you want, and they tapped the stone with these wands. And the stone started to actually oscillate at such a high intensity that it became literally inertia-free, and they could just shove these things about. They were struck again. The oscillation stopped and they just went boink and they just sat down and were originally as heavy as they were. I think that has got some mileage in it, to be honest with you. So I think that is a possibility that some sort of external device like these were used. But as to whether they're ET, well, possibly. But the question arrives, why would they even bother? Why would they want these things to be erected? I mean, if the pyramids were not going to be of any use to them directly, why would they bother helping the Egyptians to actually construct them? Unless, of course, as has been suggested, not just by me, that the pyramids were actually devices in their own right, which could be activated for some as yet unknown purpose.
A motor or a battery.
Mm. Yeah, pretty much.
So there are still secrets, there are still parts of the pyramids that we have, the Great Pyramid particularly, that haven't accessed. So there are still secrets to be revealed.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I just love to be there. I hope I'm still alive when they finally do. Just like I hope I'm still alive when they finally get to Mars and we start answering a few questions there, but that's an entirely different
subject. Well, the date of that seems to be pushed back and back and back. One of the things also, I mean, the reason I would recommend this book to anybody who is new to all of these things is that this is a pretty good smorgasbord, and it's very clear as an introduction. This would be a great primer for somebody, mm-hmm. you know, who was interested in these things, perhaps has heard my podcast or seen my TV show and they want to know a little bit more. Then, you know, I think you could do a lot worse than this book. Page 75, you talk about psychic warfare.
And in particular,
a man called Colonel John Alexander, PhD, born 1937, normal childhood, highly successful military career, officially retired, you say, in 1988. Mm-hmm. And you say, quote, this man came to accept that ancient concepts and experiments, which in any other context might be described as magical, could be harnessed for military advantage. It's a great story behind that.
Oh, yeah. Well, John Alexander, he was used, or his knowledge, I think he was a bit past it, but he had retired from the US, by the army by that time. But his techniques were used in extracting information from people. Other things that Alexander was involved in was something like Stargate. He was involved in stuff like that. I mean, near magical processes. But they're not near magical because it's an innate talent that all human beings have, whether they believe it or not. Those flashes of insight that we sometimes get, those sort of deja vu moments, these are not, as psychiatrists or psychologists would have you believe, some sort of aberration within the brain and the mind. These are flashes of talents we used to possess. More openly, not so much now, it has to be said, because it's bred out of us, or we're taught not to accept them as being real. We're taught to accept it's just our imagination, although there again I think this is starting to, you know, that there's so much been learned about the processes of the human mind and just how complex a machine is. I think it's been called the most complex computer in the universe, the human brain. But Alexander, as I say, he was involved in a lot of highly classified intelligence operations, and a lot of these are going into the actual chapter itself, as I recall.
Yes, there's a lot there. Has he spoken about any of this?
Usually to deny it.
Okay, well, no, that's interesting. Connected with this, of course, is remote viewing. Now, you don't specifically, I don't think, talk about that in the book. No. Like I say, I read it very quickly, but I see no reference to it. No. But, you know, that is a facet of mind. I would say that my jury is 75% convinced that remote viewing is a thing and it works, there's that 25% of doubt. But isn't it interesting that we know a lot about American and Russian experiments in remote viewing, and as far as I'm aware, very little about what the Brits might have done?
Well, that is a pity, because we did... Don't ask me where I got the information, because at this moment in time I can't remember. But we did have a go at this, but the results I'm not too sure about, but... As with everything involved with the British government, the British state, if we think that the Americans tend to be a bit cagey about their stuff and the Russians and all the rest of it cagey, the British state could teach them lessons on how to conceal information and total and absolute denial, and consistent and absolute denial. But I'm sure we tried the same thing, because it was too good a military device, if you want to call it that way, to actually ignore and just put to one side. Of course we did. Although what the results were, again, you'll never get to know. You'll never find out.
Which brings me to some of your most interesting research that you were directly involved in.
Mm-hmm.
And again, periodically it pops up on TV, and periodically some tabloid paper will publish a piece about it, almost as filler material, but it's fascinating. Mm-hmm. Place in Scotland called Ross Lynn Chapel.
Oh, yeah.
Now, it's been said for a very long time that Ross Lynn Chapel has a portal to another dimension within it.
Mm-hmm.
You've researched that.
Yes.
What did you do and what did you find?
Okay. The first question, does Rosslyn Chapel have a portal within it? The answer to that is yes, it does.
Mm.
I know where to the inch that it is, and I also believe I know how to activate it. Now, this was backed up during the summer. It was Steve Mira and Vitaly. They had a conference in Blackpool in the Winter Gardens, and there was a lot of guys there. They were coming, you know, guys from the US. Rick Doty was there, amongst others. And they were talking about portals. And I said to Rick Doty that I know where there is a portal. I know where it works. He said, go and talk to that guy. And I can't remember the guy's name, but he was sitting down signing books. But I didn't get a chance to talk to him. But he knew, Doty knew about the portal in Chapel. He knew all about it, but didn't know where it was, didn't know what it was, didn't know how it worked. We found out by accident, and I'm not going to, you know, butter this up, by sheer accident in 1996. It was 96 or 98. Because we were standing in the chapel, in the Lady Chapel, at the left-hand side where the St. Matthew altar is. Because the portal is right in front of the St. Matthew altar, which is about, as you stand in front of the altar, it's not a huge big thing. It's maybe about chest height, and it's maybe about 3 or 4 feet wide. There's actually three altars in the Lady Chapel, and one which is at called the High Altar, appropriately enough, which is above the stairs going down into the crypt. But I was standing at this altar, and I had a couple of mediums with us at the time, and we're only doing some for interest, just as a matter of interest. We'll go up and have a look at this place. Oh yeah, we'll take some mediums with us. Great idea, we'll take mediums with us. And the medium said, they were completely separate at the time, they didn't know each other, and they'd never been in the chapel before. And one medium said to me, there's an astral doorway and it's right behind you.
Doorway?
An astral doorway, she called it, an astral doorway, yeah. And it's right behind you. I said, yeah, okay, well, and we left it at that. I didn't pursue it anymore. Then I have to be standing by the altar again, and the other medium came up, and she looked and went, oh, there's an astral doorway there. And I said, is there? Oh, yeah, right. And I swear to God, this is the God's honest truth. When she said that, I'd been sort of standing fairly relaxed with my arms at my sides. My arms started to drift up from my sides and just drifted up and drifted up. And I went, whoa, what's going on? Then I literally felt myself, it was like somebody like rams under my heels and was pushing me up from the floor.
Levitation.
Yeah, almost, yes, virtually came off the floor. And I pitched forward and I went, what the hell was that? Ah, she said, that's the astral doorway starting to switch itself on or starting to materialise. And I went, whoa, wait a minute, you know. So I did some discreet inquiries of the staff that looked after the chapel, and all I got was a dirty look. Basically, and we don't talk about that kind of stuff here.
Who did you ask?
Well, the guides, if you like, but uh-huh. If they knew, they weren't going to tell you anyway, I suspect, because they don't like that kind of information getting out about the chapel. Because anytime you go, you move away from the fact that the chapel is a building that was built in the 1400s and it was a place of worship, end of. That's all they want to know. They'll show you. They'll tell you about the architectural anomalies, the carvings, and all the rest of it. But they will not go into the more esoteric side of it. Now, in the Lady Chapel, in the ceiling of the Lady Chapel, there are like collections. There are arcs of cubes that go up from the pillars up into the ceiling, and each of these cubes has got a different pattern on it. And it had been speculated, not by me, I might ask. But it'd been speculated that these cubes, that the patterns on these cubes represented musical notes. Now, I did some digging into this, and I came up with a concept called the Chladni pattern, Chladni, Chladni pattern. They were created, he was also called, I think, the father of acoustics, this guy was named as. It's now called cymatics, is the term they give it. But it's basically, What he was doing was he was getting like a sheet of glass, a thin metal plate, securing it at one corner, sprinkling fine sand and drawing a bow down it. And depending on the note that was struck, that was created, the sand would take a pattern up, But it's just a fact of, it's a fact of life. It does. They do. It does. In fact, the television company once did it in my house. They actually did this in my house on my dining room table. And I said, what the hell are you doing? they were trying to clamp this device to the table. I said, what are you doing? Stop it. Anyway, they did it and they proved it worked. So, a friend of mine, a guy called Bill Downey, he knew what I was trying to do with this thing. And he came up with, I think it was F sharp, C and A were the particular notes. But they form a particular note, an augmented fourth. And it would appear that the augmented fourth, if played at the correct intensity, will open this portal. And in 2006, that was the last time we officially got into the chapel to do this sort of thing, because they just won't let you anywhere near now to try this. Within the chapel, they will not normally let you do this sort of thing. And what we did is we got in one Sunday morning before the paying customers got in. And we set up a computer. We set up the computer using just a laptop that I'd put down a set of tones on, so a set of frequencies. And we started, you know, playing the frequencies. But before we go into that, there was something else happened. While we were allowing the computer to generate this frequency, one of the guys, Nathan, he went down into the crypt and he started toning. And we could hear him down in the crypt toning, just using his voice tone. So you had him toning up downstairs, the laptop producing this tone, and we're sort of looking at each other, oh, that's nice. Then all of a sudden, the chapel produced a third tone on its own, completely on its own. It took the two tones and created a harmonic on its own. And we thought, wow, that's pretty good. Then a few seconds later, a fourth tone kicked off, or a second harmonic kicked off. So the chapel was producing two tones entirely on its own without any production from us, only using the guy downstairs toning and the computer producing this particular note.
So the questions about that are, who designed it that way and what did they know?
Sir William Sinclair, he designed it that way because I think... Well, I'll carry on. I'm just going from there. Sure. The guy down the stairs, Nathan, he stopped toning, and the two additional tones stopped instantly. Bang! They just switched off, like a switch going off. So the two harmonics stopped. So what we're left with then was the computer producing this tone, and one of the mediums said, "Ah, something's happening over at the altar." And that was when she went and stood with her back to the altar, and I went over and stood in front of her, and I swear to God, the temperature was like being in the bottom of a freezer. Bang, the temperature just dropped immediately. And we could feel stuff like, it was like rising cold rather than rising warm. You know, it was like the cold was rising up from the floor, and you could put your hands out on either side of you. And it was putting your hands through a defined mark, and it was warmer on the outside. You brought your hand back in and it was colder on the inside. So something was happening on the altar and it was reacting directly to the tone we were producing. So we didn't know what to do next because we just didn't know what was going to happen anyway when we tried this. But we do know that whatever it is on that altar will produce, it will react to specific tones. The clue to the tones that we got came from the patterns and the cubes that are above, you know, that are in the Lady Chapel. And I think Sinclair deliberately created that device, let's call it, for a specific purpose. I think he was trying to conceal something. But the other kicker is, for centuries, there's been, if you like, a legend that the physical gateway to heaven is in the chapel. Okay, down in the crypts, not the crypt you can get into, but the other under the chapel. And this gateway to heaven, I think, was a sort of a memory of what Sinclair did. That people knew they had done something very special in that chapel, and they viewed this portal as being the gateway to heaven. And I think that is how the two become, how the story of the gateway to heaven became a separate entity to the existence of the portal, because I think they're one and the same thing.
So, two other questions. Full of questions, aren't I? But two other questions. You know, why that location? And if this thing is used properly, assuming the chapel is some kind of device, just making that assumption and accepting it for now, you know, why would it be there? And if you make use of it, where would you go? And has anybody that we know ever done that?
Right. First, why the chapel? The chapel is built on a confluence of ley lines. Okay, I know exactly where they are, and I know exactly where to stand people if they want to experience them. And everybody that I've asked to stand on this spot has gone, whoa, what are you doing? What's happening? The first time I experienced this was back in the 90s. That was the first time when we found there was something very strange about this altar. That one of the mediums that was with us said, stand there. And if you go down into the... Have you ever been in Rosslyn Chapel, Hart?
Never.
No, okay. If you go down into the crypt, which is up at the end of the chapel, down in the crypt, maybe 10 paces along to your left-hand side, there's a little room. It's where they used to... It's where they stored the drawings when they were building the chapel, would you believe it? They kept all their stuff in there. And if you go inside that little door and turn slightly to your right and stand with your eyes shut, when I got it, it was like standing on the deck of... It was like standing on a rubber mat that was on top of water. I could feel the whole thing going under my feet. Stuff where it was moving, okay? And I opened my eyes and there was somebody, one of the guys was standing with his hands, one in the front, one in the back of me in case I fell over. And he said, did you feel that? I said, yeah, I did. So he said, what was it? So I told him, so here you go, and he tried it. Now, when we were up there, last year? That was the last time we were there. But the people that were with me, I asked them to stand on the spot and they went, whoa! They felt it straight away, so... The actual location of this portal is literally more or less above the confluence of the ley lines. Maybe just a little to the front of them, but it's certainly in the vicinity of those ley lines. And there is, as I say, there's a confluence, there's a number of ley lines converge underneath the chapel. But that location has been a site of worship since ancient times, thousands of years ago. I think there's a temple of Mithras there as well. The Romans had a temple of Mithras around that area as well. And Mithras, as you probably know, was also always worshipped underground. So that would make perfect sense in the purpose for which the chapel is used. Although, when it was built in the 1400s, it was ostensibly supposed to be the retro choir of a larger cathedral that was never built. Although there's loads of books will argue different things about that, what the chapel was used for, what was intended for. Basically, the simple answer was it was a place of worship for the Sinclair family, end of. That was it. But I think Sir William Sinclair, when he built it, I think he built it to conceal something, and it was concealed on the other side of this portal, where unless you had very, very specialised knowledge, you'd never get at it. But what it was it concealed, I have no idea.
Is anybody researching, as far as you know, anybody researching this now?
No, because they think I'm crazy, basically.
Well, there are a lot of people who talk about this. It's an enigma and a mystery. I must make a point of going there and standing there. And, you know, I think I'm fairly sensitive about things. If there was something to be sensed, then I think I'd probably be sensing it. How fascinating. In your life, then, and as you said, you're north of 80 now and looking very well on it, I can actually see you.
Oh, God bless you.
just briefly, what in your life is the strangest thing that you've personally experienced, Brian?
Actually, I'm actually just south of 80, not north. Come on.
Oh, sorry.
but just south. The strangest thing I've ever experienced. Have we ever spoken before? Have I ever been in your show before, Howard?
You have. We did a short bit a while back, yes.
Okay. I wondered. What I think is the strangest thing ever happened to me was, and I can't remember if we discussed it at the time, was when I was 2.5, 3 years old, and that was what turned me on to this whole subject. And I can see the vision now as if it happened literally 2 minutes ago. It's burned into my brain. I'm lying in my cot, I wake up, the sunlight's streaming past the foot of the cot, it's a bright day, and I'm wide awake. And between me... And the other thing that was about 6-7 feet away from me was my father kept a baby grand piano, of all things, in the bedroom. It was the only place he had room to keep it. But between me and the baby grand piano, there was something standing, a humanoid figure, about 4 feet high, all dressed in green, and it was watching me. It had his arms folded, and around its waist, it was wearing a belt, but it can't have been a belt, because where the buckle should have been, it was a device of some kind. Okay, it was a device, and it was watching me. But I didn't sense any threat, and I opened my eyes and closed my eyes and shook my head a little bit. And it was standing, and it was there, and it was watching me. So being a child, you don't worry about these things too much. And I fell asleep again. And when I woke up, I had gone. Well, about a few months later, in the same room, and I didn't put this together until maybe 10, 15 years ago, had a vision, a lucid dream, for want of a better word. And this lucid dream was was of a spacecraft. Your traditional, so it's saucer shape, you know, your two plates, one on top of the other, the traditional flying saucer. And this thing was enormous, and I knew that it had come for me. It was for me. And it's not until about 15 years ago, and this just shows you how these things knock around, you never make the connection. I suddenly made the connection that one was part of the other, or one was from the other, and for some reason I had been selected for some reason. Don't know what, still don't know what. Maybe I'll find it before I finally pop off, or maybe after I pop off, who knows. But yeah, this thing was sent to mark me and to recognize that I was intended to do something. Maybe it's what I'm doing just now, who knows.
So you believe, as a lot of people believe, and I can understand why they do, that you've been guided in all
of
this.
Yeah, 100%, 100%, yes.
Brian Allen, thank you so much. We've only scratched the surface. 14 books. Is this number 15 or is this number 14? I think this is number
15. It's number 14. I've actually, two were co-written, but the last one with Barry Fitzgerald, it was co-written. So this is my 14th book.
Barry, top man. Great fan of Barry Fitzgerald.
Great guy, yeah.
Book of Secrets, Aliens, Ghosts and Ancient Mysteries. We've talked about some of the contents of the book, and we've also talked around it, especially that fascinating discussion that never ceases to amaze me of Rosalind Chapel. I know we'll talk about that again. Brian, thank you so much for giving me your time today.
You're more than welcome, Howard. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Brian Allen, and of course the book, The Book of Secrets, is published by Flying Disc Press, which is controlled amazingly by the remarkable Philip Mantle. And thanks to Philip for all of his help with my shows over the years. All right, more great guests in the pipeline here at the Home of the Unexplained. So until next we meet, my name is Howard Hughes. This has been The Unexplained Online. And please, whatever you do, stay safe, stay calm. And above all, please stay in touch. Thank you very much. Take care. Bye-bye.